the OTV Sports app. Listen to OTV Sports Radio 24/7, plus all your favorite podcasts, including OTV Gold.
Are you a complete rookie?
The OTV Sports app, available to download now from your app store. The OTV Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Sadio Mane should have been sent off last night. That's the lead on a lot of the back pages, trying to foment some reason for us all to watch football for the rest of the season, because otherwise, the year is over. The league title is won. Unless it's going to be Everton who put it up to Liverpool and go toe-to-toe for the whole rest of the year, which nobody can just quite believe at the moment. The season is over.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite go that far. Football is littered with teams that win their first five or six games and you think are absolutely unstoppable. And there's a bit of a setback and suddenly things start to crumble and you draw a couple of matches and you end up losing a game here or there. And then you find yourself 5-6 points behind. So I don't think Liverpool will be getting ahead of themselves just yet, but they couldn't have started the season any better. And last night was Liverpool at their very, very best. It was, I'd say, their best performance since the Manchester United win back in January. Okay, there's some decent games after lockdown, but there was no pressure on, so they didn't really matter. But right from the start, right from Sadio Mane, at the very beginning of the game when he clashed first with Hector Bellerin, you could see Liverpool were up for this. And just the intensity and the work rate from every single player. I watched Fabinho closely for the last 10 minutes of the first half, and the amount of ground he covers when the opposition have the ball without ever touching it, just getting over in behind Mane, just getting over in behind Salah, blocking all the avenues that Arsenal were trying to progress forward. And there was nothing really in it for him. He's just doing it because it's his job and because he has to do it. And that attitude, comparing, and it's unfortunate for Manchester City, the game came straight after the Leicester match, but just comparing the attitude of the two players, again, looks as though it's going to be the difference between Liverpool and City.
And there's nobody else, is there, really, at this stage, who we can actually see sustaining a title challenge over the course of the season?
No, I think maybe, and this changes quickly, a couple of weeks ago we thought if Manchester United could continue the form with the front four on absolute fire, Danny van de Beek comes in, Paul Pogba finds a role where he's at his very best, and they strengthen defensively, maybe they could put a run at it. But none of those things have happened, and it's hard to see United, like, it feels with United, in fact, it's only going one way and that they're going to lurch from crisis to crisis. Chelsea haven't made any significant improvements, though I still think they'll get better when they finally get everybody on the pitch. And Arsenal are still, while they are unquestionably improving, I thought last night, again, there were signs that they're a bit more solid, a bit more organised than they were previously, and they didn't capitulate last night against Liverpool. They're still just too far behind. So it is Liverpool, Manchester City. Unless Ruben Diaz comes in and is some sort of Virgil van Dijk-style transformative figure of that Manchester City team, not just in terms of his talent, but in terms of can he change the attitude? Can he somehow bring that dressing room back together and get them doing what Pep Guardiola had them doing 3-4 seasons ago?
Well, that's what the papers are saying this morning. One of the coaches who worked with him as a kid said that on his first day of training at Benfica, he was giving the old thing to Luis Shaw, who had to turn around and tell him to shut up. And that's several years ago. Since then, he's become a leader and a man. And at 23, he's ready to ascend to, you know, the role of the new Vincent Kompany.
Yeah. Are the rest of the Manchester City dressing room ready for that? Or when he comes in after 3 weeks, are they going, see this guy, the manager? We've had to listen to this for 4 years and we're a little bit sick of it right now. So we're kind of done. But maybe. And that is the hope, because it doesn't look as though Liverpool are going to go away. It looks as though they're going to be pretty much as relentless as they were last year. I didn't think they'd get to 90, 95 points again. But going on last night, you wouldn't bet against them getting quite close.
Like, it could be a sense where, like, I know it feels like it's a leap to a conclusion that the title race is already over, and on the evidence, it's obviously not. But seriously speaking, it definitely could be over by December because of the games that they play the immediate aftermath. It's Manchester City right before the international break, Leicester City right after the international break in November. The Leicester game is the 21st of November. If they win those games back to back, there is definitely a sense of unease about where United, Arsenal and Chelsea are at, that Liverpool just simply can't be caught from that position.
And that's what happened last season. It was around that November time when Liverpool played Manchester City first time out, where City had dropped points the previous week and Liverpool all of a sudden have an opportunity to open up, I think it was a 9-point gap at the time, which they did. still think it's a bit early. We're only three games in. Say,
I know. You were making the point, like, history is littered with teams who win their first five games. History is not littered with a brilliant team like this Liverpool side who, you know, there aren't that many times where an amazing team who are clearly the class of the group establishes early doors what's going to happen. The Man United team used to do it where they would win, they would break the soul and the spirit of all of their opponents very early on in the season, and nobody could catch them. It was pointless even dreaming to catch them.
Oh, and everything that's happening now feels like the reverse of what was going on with Liverpool in the mid-90s and Manchester United back then, where you would look at teams going to Old Trafford and think they've thrown in the towel before they even got there. Like they're not even attempting to win this game. They know they're beaten before they arrive at the stadium. And I think the vast majority of teams that Liverpool play, you look at them and it seems like that as well. And Liverpool aren't going to give most teams a sniff. And I could understand in a way why Klopp was a bit annoyed with what he heard, even though Roy Keane has obviously been incredibly complimentary, because he was looking at that and thinking, all right, we made one mistake by Andy Robertson. But aside from that, it was pretty much flawless. And I suspect he may have come from other interviews where maybe there were questions about other opportunities. But like some of them opportunities were offside, where people are looking at those as, well, oof. And maybe that'll be accentuated with the new way they're dealing with offside and leaving it longer. They're offside. So he's looking at that as perfect defending. And the way Liverpool play with as high a press as any team in world football, offside is a key part of the defensive system. So if the flag goes up straight away, it looks like good defending. If Lacazette goes clear through and maybe should take the chance, and I know there was one other one, I don't think Klopp has an issue with that. And I think he looks at that as actually, that's us doing our job to perfection.
Well, Lacazette should have made it 2-2.
He had that one opportunity. But teams are always going to have chances. But I'd still say I don't think he's awake at night worrying about where Liverpool are defensively. They've conceded 4 goals so far this season. 2 of them were horrendous individual errors. So maybe there's, you know, Van Dijk's was different to Robertson's last night. And they've conceded 2 absolutely sensational goals from Leeds, which is the sort of goal they can always concede when they're pressing that high. That if a team has the quality in their locker to pick them apart at the right time, you can get in behind them. But they just suffocate the life out of teams. So there's very few players or teams that have the quality to do that. So they'll take that chance. Like, that is the risk you play with this system. So he's never going to change that. And the chance of most teams scoring a goal like Leeds did in the first game of the season are very, very slim. We've seen it, you know, the odd time here and there across last season as well. But that is what you're doing when you're pressing that high.
Hopefully, as a neutral in this, there's a template there from what everybody has seen. And we want Liverpool to drop some points at some point, particularly early on in the season, to give everybody a sense of it. Comment from Richard on YouTube. Dodge the Mane chat straight off the bat. Textbook political tactics there, Nathan. Sadio Mane should have been sent off for the elbow. It would have been a different game.
Yeah, of course it would have been. And I think on first look, it definitely looked like a red card. When you saw the replay from the other side, maybe the elbow wasn't quite as sort of straight in. It was more a straight arm than a straight elbow. Owen, you may disagree strongly.
I thought on first look it was a red card for sure, but it was always going to be a yellow card. There was never any doubt that he wasn't going to survive that. Like, what I found interesting as well is that at the start of the second half, Trent Alexander-Arnold goes in on Kieran Tierney, leaves a little bit on him. And I guess maybe I'm just reading too much into this. It was the same player, obviously. There was a lot of talk before the game where it's like, yeah, we can expect Arsenal to hurt Liverpool down the left flank. It's the left flank. It's Tierney and Aubameyang. They're going to do a bit of damage to them. And I wonder if they thought to themselves, let's just hammer the hammer. Let's just pin them back into their own half, show a bit of aggression, leave a mark on them sort of thing. And I'm not sure if that's just too much of a leap from me there.
To target Kieran Tierney? Maybe. But played in the back three like that, Tierney's never going to get forward as much as True. Arsenal would have wanted. And like the difference between this game and the Community Shield was all about Liverpool, was the intensity. So Arsenal obviously scored that brilliant goal in the Community Shield, and they scored some brilliant goals building from the back.
It's a friendly. But no one cares about the Community Shield except Arsenal. No one cares. Liverpool didn't care about it.
They didn't, but I think that actually it showed the difference in attitude last night massively from the Community Shield.
Yes.
Arsenal had a lot of time to play it out from the back, whereas time and time again, Liverpool had them right pinned back inside the 6-yard box. And that's what they do. That's what they do to all teams. They, like, look at the goal Sadio Mane scored against Chelsea from the kick out from Kepa. Like, the press is getting higher, if anything, from Liverpool.
Okay.
Just suffocating the life out of teams. So it wasn't much Arsenal could do about that.
You've obviously seen a lot of Klopp. Why is he reacting to Keane? There's a theory that is just beginning to form that perhaps he is a little bit concerned about something. That maybe the sloppiness in the Leeds game and actually Leeds' template for punting the ball into the corners and trying to win a race with somebody fast creates lots of opportunities. And there's a bit of a template there. And Lacazette should have made it 2-2 last night. That there is a possibility that something has slipped to a point where he's just not as confident as he always has been about this team.
Just before we get to Klopp, firstly on the Leeds of setting a template, like Leeds play like that week in, week out. So they're well prepared to go and take on Liverpool in that sort of game. If Aston Villa take on Liverpool in that game on Saturday, they're going to get beaten 5 or 6-0. Like, Aston Villa need to sit tight and hope for the best. That is what Aston Villa need to do, try and stay in the game for an hour. If they try and go and play that game, long balls down to the corner, pressing up high, not letting Liverpool out, they're going to get absolutely hammered. So I don't think most teams can do that.
Did Leeds goals not really come on the counter?
Not really. No, they were building out from the back.
I mean, it was like long ball to the midfield, long ball to the left wing, bang, goal.
Keeper rolls it out, or comes up the left-hand side. There's a bit of space inside his own half, and it's a long ball down the left. But again, Liverpool are always going to press high. But I don't think it was that Liverpool had committed too many men forward. Like, Liverpool will always play like that. But that... I don't think a Villa or a Newcastle or any of those teams are set up that when they lose the ball. So Leeds, when they lost the ball then, were actually very well set up most of the time. So they could keep Liverpool back inside their own half for long enough to reorganise themselves. I just think other teams, like, they don't play like that week in, week out. So you can't just suddenly try and change it for Liverpool and become more attacking against Liverpool. It is an accident waiting to happen. On the Klopp thing, like, he's always surprisingly intense post-match.
Touchy.
Even when they win. The one thing that always surprised me was that, like, he'd come over after doing his press conference and he'd come and talk to the radio lads for 5-6 minutes and they'd won. And you'd always think he'd be very chilled out and relaxed and laughing and joking. It was always all business. Very few smiles, real intense, almost waiting again for that sort of criticism, particularly if they had one where he was happy and he felt they'd done their job, that if there was any little bit of criticism, he was ready to hop on it. And like all managers, there's a message there to the players as well. I'm not sure if I go along with the theory that it was a Manchester United legend and he's laying down a bit of a marker of, well, this is the rivalry we want.
It helps.
You know, Liverpool, Manchester United, me knocking Roy Keane off his perch. Does he know the sort of full history of Roy Keane? I'm not sure if he does. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But yeah, he compared to any other manager, I would have found him, and I didn't have many dealings with him at all, but the most intense post-match, the most ready, even in victory, to go to bat for his team.
So this is part of his character. It's also part of how he does business. We're not to think that this is somehow him stepping out or responding in the moment to Keane. It was like, whenever anybody attacks me, I am going to go on the attack. And that's what my players expect. And as Owen was saying, it's all that. How did you describe all that stuff about it meaning more?
Well, I think that it's what Nathan said there, willing to go to bat for his team. And I think that you can talk about all the, mystique around Liverpool Football Club. This means more, everything around the whole aura of Anfield. But Jurgen Klopp has tapped into that unbelievably successfully. And part of that has to be going to bat for your team every single night. And if it's Roy Keane, if it's Jeff Shreves, it doesn't matter. Whoever it is saying it, it doesn't matter if they're a former Manchester United player or not. Jurgen Klopp is going to come at you if you say anything about his team. You may say that's unreasonable, but there is a reason for that from Klopp's perspective and a psychological reason for that from his perspective, and I think that's fair enough. But it is also fair enough to say, yeah, you're being a little bit prickly, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was Roy Keane would probably be a bit annoyed when he came off air last night that all this happened, if he felt, because of sort of technical issues and they couldn't have a proper back and forth about things, where, you know, Keane was obviously been very complimentary about Liverpool by and large and said they were a bit sloppy, which they were. Like, I think, you know, Alexander-Arnold in particular in the first half gave the ball away on 3 or 4 occasions where they weren't quite at it. But Klopp is without question, I'd say, coming off thinking, you know, Arsenal are one of the best 5 or 6 teams in the Premier League right now. and we've played them off the park. We've pinned them into their own half, and it's one of our best performances in months and months and months. And the first thing I hear when I put on my headphones is sloppy, sloppy. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the type of thing Ferguson would have done. It really
exactly,
is.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I think there's a sort of a different view of Klopp because of the nice guy persona that is out there. And I'm sure it's not a persona. It is what he is when he's not in this psycho intense mode. But because he's so jovial a lot of the time, people expect that all the time. And when it sort of flips, it's like, whoa, what's going on here? Whereas Ferguson, there was always that intensity.
The hagiography that surrounds Mikel Arteta is interesting when you compare and contrast it with the knives out approach to Frank Lampard. I understand that there's 250 million difference in the spending, but it's fair to argue that neither club has actually made that much progress in terms of the table since the arrival of the two managers. Again, Lampard's been there a good bit longer. I just think it's interesting that Mikel Arteta is the second coming of Jesus Christ, according to most of the stuff that I read and how the conversations go. And yet it seems to me, I'm doubting Thomas here. I want to put my hand in the gaping wounds. I want to feel the fleshy blood and see, okay, actually, you are the second coming of the risen Lord here, Mikel. Like, I can feel the bits where, you know, you've been stabbed.
Who were the knives out for like Frank Lampard? Like, sorry, Nathan, I know you're trying to come in there. Just one quick thing on that. I think it's very important to judge the basis here. Chelsea were Premier League champions 3 years ago. Arsenal haven't won a Premier League title since the Invincibles. They've stagnated for so long. And yes, your own argument falls down when you mention the 250 million. It falls down immediately when you say that. Yes, Arsenal have made bad signings themselves, but that is why there is a difference in standards. They're coming from a higher base, and they have spent a lot more money.
Arsenal still look like the same flaky Arsenal when the moment came, when it was going to be 2-2, when you were going to put some pressure on the champions and make them think again. Straight at the goalkeeper. Thanks very much. That's what you get.
Is that a Mikel Arteta? Is that a club-wide failing in your view?
I mean, I can just go by the fact that the manager's in charge of how everything works, and Arteta, as the second coming of Jesus, is supposed to have his striker make it 2-2.
There's nothing he can do about that. They create a chance, as you say, they score that chance, and suddenly it's a brilliantly organised Arsenal team who've held out and shown a bit of character. I don't think you compare Lampard and Arteta. Arsenal have been in some sort of existential crisis for a decade at this stage, where the supporters don't trust the players, don't like the players, don't like the attitude, don't like the style. Just didn't like the club. Like, they were quite literally fighting with each other in the stands at times. I think back to when Liverpool went 4-1 up at Arsenal 3-4 years ago. So that's where they're coming from, a low, low place. They want to be better organised. I think they're realising it's going to take a long time in a climate where they're not spending more money than anybody else. So they need a manager who can just get them organised and bit by bit try and build themselves back up. Chelsea have splashed the cash this year and have said, yeah, I've done that, with an expectation that they should be pushing closer to a Premier League title. But I think Arteta's done well. He has them playing a definite style of play, which will be good enough to beat the vast majority of teams. It's a more attractive style of play. Again, still think there's questions about them defensively. He doesn't seem to know exactly who his central midfielder is and what his best selection there is. So there's a lot of work to do. But from where they were under Unai Emery, and particularly in the last while under Arsene Wenger, I think they've made pretty giant leaps.
How do you see that, though? Like, what can you... I am just asking questions about this, right? Because I really hope that Arteta makes Arsenal a force to be reckoned with, and their attacking trio is pretty exciting. But I'm surprised at how quickly everyone's like, oh, this is great. This is brilliant. But, like, they weren't in that game last night. All of the reports in the papers, apart from the suggestion that Mane should have been sent off, which would have changed the game, even then, from what I'm reading, 10-man Liverpool would have, like, bossed the game and won it 2-0 because all of a sudden they're on edge and the mistake doesn't happen. Like, where's the evidence, really? They won the cup. Villa beat Arsenal last year at the end of the season. Like,
yeah, but you're comparing Liverpool last night to, if not the best team in Europe, the second best team in Europe. And they're a long, long way away from that. Arsenal were taking on one of the top two teams in Europe last night. So they're always going to struggle against a team like that. And it would be some sort of a smash and grab if they're to go and win that. But sorry, I've just got a 2-year-old smashing the place up in front of me here.
Smashing and grabbing.
She's just
she hates you, our conversation at all.
She's like, let me in. What is this guy on about?
I know what you're trying to say in a way, Gerard. Like, what is the actual measurable way of progress? Because there was a lot of bad results under Arteta at the end of last season.
You said
sure.
You'd be happy with a sixth place finish if they were pushing for fourth, Owen. That's like.
I didn't say that. I didn't say I'd be happy with a sixth place finish there. I was saying that would be an actual step forward, considering how desperate they have been for the last couple of seasons. But actually, just to go along with the sound of caution for a moment, because like I think it's quite easy for Jamie Carragher to sit in a Sky studio and say, whoever comes up against Liverpool, they'll be there in a couple of years. You know, look at Jurgen Klopp when he started for Liverpool. Things were tough, and it took, you know, 4 or 5 years for things to get to the level that they're at now. I don't think you can automatically throw that at every club with a young manager and say that they are going to reach Liverpool's level. Like, if anything, there was a minuscule chance of that ever happening. So I think that it's worth tempering that a little bit, that if people are excited about Mikel Arteta being the second coming of Jurgen Klopp on a Premier League team, I think they need to park those expectations for sure. Like, you look at, say, the start of the Jurgen Klopp era at Anfield, and looking at the players that he immediately came into the club and who stayed to their current day of success. And I know he's gone now, but you had Dejan Lovren, who was 26. You had Joe Gomez, who was 19. You had an athletic freak in James Milner, who is the outlier here, who was 30. Henderson was 26. Firmino was 24. This is the sort of age profile you're talking about. In the second season, then, when Wijnaldum is in there at 26, Sadio Mane's in there at 25, and Trent Alexander-Arnold comes in at the age of 18. If you're basing Arsenal off that base, look at their front three right now. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is 31, Willian is 32, Lacazette is 29. They're not going to be there at the end of this 3, 4, 5-year plan. They're certainly not going to be playing at their current level unless Aubameyang is a James Milner type freak, which I accept there is a chance. But it's not going to be the same level of a vertical-esque curve that Liverpool have shown. Like, you go back to midfield, and Nathan's dead right that there are so many issues here as well. Like, I mean, Xhaka is 28, Elneny is 28, but actually the problem there is not their age at all. It's that they're very ordinary midfielders. And I know that they're trying to go out and sign Partey or Aouar, and they're both at the right age profile. But these are the sort of necessary signings. These aren't just like luxury signings.
But sorry, your argument about giving them time to build, like the counter to that is their front trio now are a win now team, and so therefore it with that group, it like anything less than Champions League is essentially failure.
My point is that they have made progress under Mikel Arteta. My point is that, and my point there about the age profile is that people who are getting excited about this being a project for the future needs to check their expectation in case the checkbook doesn't come out.
But then they're trapped.
Would a top four?
They are trapped. Well, that's a good point. They are. You're right. They are. But remember, they did well to finish in the top half of the table last season. So finishing in the top four would be progress. And they are trapped because if they're not going to go and spend the money that their rivals are, they have an aging squad with their best players at the moment, from David Luiz, who seems to be an important player and gets put in on the big nights, to Aubameyang and Lacazette. So it is a very different thing. There's a few good young emerging players that he needs to keep. So that's the challenge of somehow getting that balance. But that's why I think there's been progress. They're good to watch again. They have a definite style of play. They look like a team who are well coached for the first time in 5 or 6 years, who have a game plan when they go out there, even if it is against Liverpool, to sit back, to soak up the pressure and try and catch them on the counter-attack. I still think that's a huge step up on where they've been over the last 2 or 3 years. But there may well be a peak for this Arsenal side that is challenging for fourth place. And that just may be the way of the world for Arsenal right now. I'm not sure they have the resources. Like, Liverpool, remember, bought Alisson and Virgil van Dijk. They spent up on 130, 40 million to improve the two key areas they needed to from a position of strength. Do Arsenal have that money? I'm not quite sure. And if they don't, how do you do that?
Well, Liverpool didn't have it either. They had to sell Coutinho to get it.
Sure. Just on your point yesterday, you were talking about Pep Guardiola. What players has he made better? Let's use that yardstick to judge Mikel Arteta by, if you're not going to accept the FA Cup as a yardstick. Like, We start with the front. Lacazette, better player under Mikel Arteta. Granit Xhaka, better player under Mikel Arteta. Mohamed Elneny, better player under Granit Xhaka. David Luiz, better player under Arteta than he certainly was under Unai Emery. You can compare him with Chelsea all you want. Hector Bellerin, better player under Mikel Arteta.
Is Bellerin now better than like when he was the outstanding right back in the Premier League?
Yeah, he's back to that level.
But he's not actually a better player. He's just getting...
He's improved under Mikel Arteta than he was before Mikel Arteta was at the club. Like, I mean, if you're going to use that yardstick for Pep Guardiola, you've got to be able to stand over that yardstick.
Yeah, and
for
fair enough, if you're telling me that he's making all these players better, then that's your answer to the question about prove to me that he's making progress, that players are actually getting better. I just think that when you do have, as you keep pointing out, this really old attacking trio that you're basing this season's success on, you've got to have success this year. And so falling short of the top four is going to end up being same old Arsenal, not quite good enough for the Champions League, which is essentially where they've been trapped since the end of the Wenger era. I do want to move on because we can come back to this and there'll be loads more evidence coming to it. All I'm saying is colour me sceptical until I see something that I haven't seen from Arsenal in the last half decade or 8 years or however long it is since they were actually properly competing for titles. The Ireland squad is going to be named today. A lot of pictures of Jack Byrne on the back of the papers. Mm. Obviously looked sensational against the second string Dundalk team the other night. Is that the main point of interest here, whether or not he gets in the squad for the Slovakia game, Nathan, or is there other stuff for us to consider?
No, I don't think so. Jack Byrne will be the one that people will focus on. He's in far better form now than he was when the last squad was announced. I know people were talking about, oh, maybe because of the League of Ireland games might have had to be cancelled, he would have had to quarantine, things like this. He just wasn't playing well. I think maybe he'd had a couple of injuries in pre-season before the restart, whereas now, again, he's comfortably back to being the best player in the league. And there should be spots in the squad. He only named a 23-man squad last time because of travel restrictions and the bubble and all that sort of stuff. But Ireland have three games in 6 days. So I'd expect he's going to add a few more players because he's going to need to use everybody over these three games. Robbie Brady is a bit of an injury. Troy Parrott is going to miss the squad through injury. So there's a couple of spots there. I'd expect he'll add either Kevin Long or Jimmy Dunn.
Both?
The squad as a possibly both. He didn't name any centre-halves even though he brought in Daryl O'Shea. So if he can, I would say he'll name a 27, 28-man squad. Maybe not all of them travel to Slovakia. But no, unfortunately, there's not too many outside of the sort of 23 who we are saying have got to come into this. But the good news is that actually a lot of those in the 23 have started the season brilliantly. So the bigger question will be what's the team selection rather than what's the squad? Because, you know, Conor Howard, whom we saw last night, getting a run of games at the start of the season for Aston Villa, contributing all over the pitch, suddenly looks very comfortable at Premier League level. James McCarthy started the season really well, but in a midfield two for Crystal Palace. So again, is there a change potentially in system to get the best out of him? Jeff Hendrick wasn't great at the weekend, but obviously is playing week in, week out. And like the main question that he's going to be asked today is Seamus Coleman or Matt Doherty? And right now, it's hard to see how you don't play Seamus Coleman.
You have to play Seamus Coleman, don't you?
I think he does. And listen, we can sit here all day and talk about what a great character Seamus Coleman is. There's no question about that. And he's the captain of this squad. I mean, he's not picked. He will do the right thing. He will not throw his toys out of the pram. But on the form he has shown, you've got to pick him. You have got to reward that. You've got to look at his experience. You've got to look at the type of game we're playing away in Slovakia in a playoff, with just how important it is. You cannot afford any defensive slip-ups. And I think you have to look at the way James Coleman has responded, and you have to start him. You may try and fit Matt Doherty in somewhere else, but I just don't see how you don't start Coleman.
I think even for the interaction with Kieran Gibbs, you're like, that guy's in my team. For the game against Slovakia, that guy is in my team.
Yeah, but that's Coleman. I'm like, Seamus Coleman should be on Paul O'Connell levels of adulation in this country. That's the type of leader he is. That's the type of character he is. Maybe we don't get to see it as much because that's not what you can be as a football captain compared to a rugby captain. But he has been the man in that Everton dressing room for 6-7 years at this stage. He is the one who is calling the players to order as they go through a succession of managers and underachieve. He is the one who's trying to bring all this together and is sitting looking on as they spend 200 million on players who fail and fail again.
And try and replace him. Like, it is. Yeah. You know, they bought his replacement last year, and he's gone from the club already. And now you have the manager comparing him with the greatest captains that he's ever managed, who are the greatest captains in football for the last two decades, with a couple of exceptions. One last Coleman question, right? Why, given there are so many teams in win-now mode, are nobody ringing them up, Everton, and going 15 million, 20 million for two seasons of Seamus Coleman at this level? Why would Manchester United not do that?
I was saying this back in January, that when Coleman was in and out of the side, that even from a pure character point of view, to bring somebody into that dressing room who brings them to some sort of order, you would spend that money on Seamus Coleman. But most clubs are looking at the bright new 23, 24-year-old who you'll get a return on investment, where actually Everton are an example of doing the opposite. Now, it's only three games, but they brought Alan in, who's 29, and they brought James Rodriguez in, who's in his late 20s, where suddenly you've players who are ready to go. There's no settling in period. They know how to do it. And Seamus Coleman is that. So I absolutely agree that, and I think the time has probably passed, but over the last couple of years, that if you wanted someone a bit different, a bit old school, a bit of character in a dressing room, like an Arsenal dressing room, what Seamus Coleman could have done there.
I think that post-injury, the form wasn't at the level it's at now. And he's back to his form. And like you would really think his game has never been based on absolute sheer pace. He obviously has had real pace at various stages, and it's important to him. But if that goes, you can still see him being a very effective defender and somebody who can influence games in the Premier League for another 3 or 4 years. So, like, would you rather have him or Aaron Wan-Bissaka in your team right now?
Right now you would say Seamus Coleman with the form he is in. But also, like, he's in this form because he's playing in a really good team. So he knows now when he gives the ball to Alan or James Rodriguez, he can bomb up the right-hand side. They're not going to lose it.
Yeah.
Like, so many times last season, Coleman is out of position. Like, this is the criticism. Everton are conceding. You see Seamus Coleman chasing back 20 yards behind. He's doing that because he's made the run he's meant to make.
Oh. Perhaps Nathan's been sabotaged by his two-year-old pulling out the... She doesn't like his Coleman take either. That's enough paper talk at the moment. I'm not suggesting that Everton would sell Seamus Coleman, but I am suggesting that if you were one of those other teams in the Premier League, you might test their resolve on that and just see if they want to get back any of the money they've spent.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.